This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am your host for the hour, Jesse Zurawell, and I'm happy to be joined once again by one of my regular guests. He is Professor Issa Bloomi. He teaches in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University, and he is the author of a number of books, most recently Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. And I understand that he is in Portugal as we speak. So without further ado, Issa, welcome back to Perspective. It's always good to speak with you. And how are you doing in Portugal?
Bom tarde. Thank you again for the invitation, Jesse. We're doing well here. We're just celebrating the anniversary of the Carnation Revolution of 1974, when leftists in all sectors of life and even members of the military finally overthrew the military dictatorship that had been ruling Portugal for many decades. So they were celebrating in the streets today, this event.
Excellent. So what does that celebration consist of? Is there any sort of formal ceremony or ceremonies, and how long does it last, and what, if anything, traditionally gets done in that celebration?
It's certainly those who are still alive who participate in those events. They're foregrounded, they're put up at front, and people show solidarity by donning carnations onto their, somehow either carrying it or putting it in their clothes or in their hair, some of them. Some of the original soldiers who stormed the media center and parliament on that day, April 25th, 1974, even with the armored vehicles that they actually drove in those days, they drive again up the main avenue of the Republic here. And unlike military equipment in a conventional military way, these armored vehicles are spray painted with a hand holding a carnation flower. And it's mostly a sign of solidarity amongst the left in Portugal, but increasingly even those who would consider themselves politically on the right are now acknowledging this as an important day in modern Portuguese history. This year has been a little bit tarnished, however, within the left, because the Communist Party has officially raised warning signs about the discourse around the Ukraine events, saying that this rather blind embrace of hostility toward Russia without making it a more complicated, understanding it in more complicated terms, has led to some elements of the left, or let's say center-left, actually banning the celebrations today, which is an interesting indication of what's actually going on in larger Europe and probably the larger world, that indeed the left is very much divided on this issue, as well as issues such as coronavirus, what to do with that whole story, and many other issues. I just met with a colleague from the university today who stated to me that he is indeed not going to the parade today because of this position he holds. Now, I bit my tongue because I don't want to get that argument with him, but I did notice that there's nothing at all, there's no sense of irony that he's talking to someone he knows who's an expert on Yemen, works and has been working for years trying to get Yemen onto the radar screen. He expresses a political class's opinion that Ukraine is a catastrophe and Russia is. He even mentioned what I find amazing, that in immediate here in Portugal, which, by the way, CNN now has a Portuguese 24-hour service to add to the endless bombardment of propaganda that people get in this country. He actually said that yesterday news media reported that Russians were openly celebrating Nazi Party, the Nazis, and were fighting in Ukraine to bring back the Nazis. And he actually told me this with a straight face. And this is really what's happening with our world. Is even people who are very well educated, who are professors at university, who work on very interesting things, and one assumes does it in ways that are sophisticated, just cannot process media and propaganda. It's just amazing.
It's
here in Portugal and everywhere else in Europe, right? Sorry, Jesse.
No, that's okay. It's astounding, though, and this started, as we've spoken about in the past, with the COVID-19 project. We saw people voluntarily abdicate their critical faculties in favor of the establishment narrative, in favor of this narrative of collectivism, which has really been a narrative of false collectivism. The idea of collective solidarity has been exploited. It's been co-opted in the name of pseudo public health and pseudo standing together. And it's been transferred over quite seamlessly into standing with Ukraine, and that on the surface being sold as another way to stand together, or we're in this together, etc. But as you said, what it really is a statement of a certain privileged political class that either is incapable of or refuses to, or both, take a complicated look at what's happening. And this is something that you've always been very adamant about doing, is complicating our examination of whatever we may be talking about, and not just settling for a reductive discourse. And that's one of the many things I appreciate about speaking with you. It's unbelievable how this reductive false narrative, false doesn't even do it justice, but for lack of a better term, how it's taken hold around the world. So you have this happening in Portugal, and I speak with my immediate family, my father, who is Ukrainian, and it's very frustrating and unfortunate, but he's fully on board with the establishment narrative and this idea that Ukraine is this pathetic, defenseless victim who did nothing to provoke what's happening. And I can't have a conversation with him about it because he won't want to listen to the facts I have to present, and he'll end up getting very angry. And he's always had this Ukrainian nationalist sense of pride. A lot of Ukrainians do, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they're of the Nazi bent. He's certainly not of that, but there's no openness even remotely to hearing another version of events, and it's frustrating, and it makes me wonder if it's something that we've rounded the corner and we can't turn back. I don't know what your sense of that is, but it seems like we've passed a point of no return in both the COVID-19 project and now with the conflict in Ukraine.
I certainly agree with that, in the sense that also that people have surrendered to not only the logic of the propaganda, but the consequences. There are dramatic structural changes that have been introduced in the course of course, the Corona period, right? So all kinds of regulations, the abuse of executive powers that just declare out of thin air, a state of emergency without any consultation with members of parliament, willingness to go through the draconian measures to that surrenders one's individual rights, the rights of your family, which has had huge consequences on people who many felt coerced to, for instance, administer a product that has been pushed in very problematic ways, in criminal ways, in fraudulent ways. And this is simply just being reapplied in the case of Ukraine, where I'm literally going shopping here and they're asking me, do you want to make a donation for Ukraine? We need to accept and understand that our lives are going to change because of the consequences of the war in Ukraine. We will be willing to pay. Of course, if you push them on it, they're not willing to pay, but they understand that they're going to have to pay more for it. Their electricity bills, for their bread, for everything. This is a very convenient way to rationalize the forthcoming dramatic change in our standard of living in Europe, and I'm sure in North America. But Jesse, this reminds me, it doesn't start with Corona. It's 9/11. I remember very well how, people just would not listen and consider that there were problems with the events that happened. I was in Istanbul at the time, and I remember watching this thing live, and I remember very well the reporters and people talking on the ground that there were bombs blowing up in the buildings.
Yes.
And then they collapsed. And then they mentioned the same thing with a third building in New York City. And then let alone all the other things that were happening in Pennsylvania Field and with the Pentagon. So in Turkey, when it was live, I heard a very different story directly from the mouth of people who were sitting there in Manhattan reporting live. Then I went back to the United States 3 months later. And the first thing I noticed was that there were all these creepy cars driving around with they were clearly security. So I immediately recognized that something had dramatically changed in American lives, that there was a new kind of level of state surveillance, that there was a new surrender to the state in terms of protecting us. And then over time I learned what people actually believe, that they're willing to accept a completely different life when they travel. I mean, this airport nonsense, the stuff that they started to introduce in the airports, in which people just did not collectively raise the red flag that this is a point of no return for us.
So it right, and it's still with us.
No one talks about it.
It was always meant to be, just like the Patriot Act.
Yes. Exactly. Which again, they were all temporary, and this is something that I'm astounded that even people on the left, even in those days, they were hesitant to challenge. Right? People were nervous if you actually challenged this narrative, and you, let alone challenge the consequences of those events on that day. Even if you were not willing to challenge the reasons behind these events. At least you should have stood up and protect people's rights from this abuse of state power, which they did not. And now that it's become clear that these things were permanent and that they've replayed this all over again, it's not bin Laden or Muslim fundamentalists, but it's a combination of a Chinese virus or a lab virus produced in American Fort Briggs, or it's a naturally occurring bat mutation. People have again gone completely mad, terrified about the world around them, terrified about their neighbors, closed themselves up, and they have allowed for an enormous power grab that is just simply built on the power grab that had been initiated in the context of the so-called war on terrorism. And we're not ever going to go back from this. I'm certain of it. And I just don't understand how people have been acclimatized. People my age, your age, who remember the days, who were adults before these events since the end of the Cold War. And we should have stood up and this is a nice segue to actually celebrate those people in 1974 in Portugal who actually said enough is enough. And I'm wondering if we're going to reach that point again, because we see that in France, people has been saying enough is enough for the last 5 years. These yellow vests protests that have basically brought down, brought French cities to their knees every weekend for years now. That brought against this new globalist order that Macron represented, and what his predecessors represented, and then they also were responding to the Corona nonsense. And yet, even though people had hundreds of thousands every weekend in throughout Europe have been protesting, if you actually just sit here in Portugal or watch the news, it doesn't seem like that these things ever happen.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I want to pick up on that. We have a new break schedule, so we have to cut to a pause right now. But when we come back, I want to pick up on that point with regard to the Gilets Jaunes, because there's something to be said about that protest that they've been continually putting up, and how power structures have responded to that. And that's something we can get into, as I said, after this short break. So more with Professor Issa Bloomi after this.
You should hear what George Eliason is talking about.
What would have happened in Donbass if Russia hesitated or waited a few days longer to start the military action?
We would not have an opportunity to talk right now. And for that moment, there would be many people would die. They would be killed by Ukrainian army.
Now, if Russia had to respond to that kind of attack instead of stopping it ahead of time, what would have been the outcome for Donbas?
So now what we see now is really the answer of Russia to what Ukraine had been done for 8 years. As we always say, Ukraine unleashed the war and was using the banned means and methods of warfare.
Aggression
towards their own people.
George Eliason on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
As an Olympic athlete, I prepare for everything. So when I became pregnant, I thought I was ready. But at 32 weeks, I was diagnosed with severe preeclampsia and had an emergency C-section. Looking back, had I known the warning signs, I would have talked to my doctor sooner. Too many women die of pregnancy-related complications, and most are preventable. If you or someone you know is pregnant or recently had a baby, learn the warning signs. It could help save her life. Hear her.
When you remember this year's holiday, will you think of the waves gently lapping on the shore? The sun setting over rolling hills? Or sat, bored out of your mind with a flat tire, waiting for a recovery truck? One in five motorway breakdowns are caused by tire problems. Before you set off, check your tire pressure. Highways England.
This is today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am your host, Jesse Zerwell, and I've been speaking once again with one of my regular guests, and I am very happy to say somebody who's become a friend, and that is Professor Issa Bloomi of Stockholm University. And Issa, just before the break, we got on to the topic of the Gilets Jaunes protests that have been happening in France continually since 2018. And in that year, the coverage was very heavy, and we could see that it wasn't a homogeneous group of protesters. There were protesters from all walks of life, if you will, who were coming together to protest austerity measures of various kinds that the neoliberal order is so fond of imposing on the people it presumes to rule. And these protests have continued, as far as I understand, up until this day. But the coverage, as is usually the case with corporate media, at least, died off almost completely. And the point I wanted to make, and I'm not the first one to make this point, I've heard other people make it as well, but I think it's a very salient point, is that these protests were very successful in mobilizing people, in waking people up to the impositions they were being put under by the neoliberal order. And the neoliberal order, those in power, realized that and realized that they had to not just use the police to suppress these protests on a weekend by weekend basis, but they had to do something larger. And the point has been made, or the theory has been put forward, that this was part of the reason we saw the Corona project, the COVID-19 project, rolled out, was because of this vast discontent, this non-homogenous discontent that was brewing among the working and even the middle classes in places like France, but certainly elsewhere. And those in power could see that they were going to lose control, and that therefore was one of the reasons that this COVID-19 pseudo pandemic was rolled out. And I think that that's a very powerful theory. There's a lot of evidence to back it up. But I'm wondering what you think about that.
I also think what was happening in France probably in many interesting ways reflects a more sophisticated reading of not only the lives that was, I mean, yes, it's gotten increasingly difficult in France. They were one of the first Western European countries, let's say, that was not Greece or Portugal or Spain, that we're going through kind of structural transformations that demanded austerity of its people, where there would be indeed dramatic changes in pensions and dramatic changes in what the state, with drawing from taxpayer revenues, would actually offer to its citizens from here on out. And I think this was happening in France. Again, one of the first Northern European countries to be going through this. Obviously, Britain had gone through this through waves. The United States had gone through it over several cycles as well. But each time, things really reached a point of no return, and really across the board, coalition could have been formed. You had the likes of Barack Obama coming in and completely undermining Occupy Wall Street and mm-hmm. the various other movements that could have brought the right and the left together, eliminating.
And he's back now.
Yeah, and he's back
now. He's I don't know. I don't know if you caught. Yeah, I don't know if you caught that speech that he recently gave at Stanford about misinformation killing people, yep. and his. Explicit admission that billions of people have been the test subjects of this experimental toxic injection. But yeah, he's back now. And I'm sure you saw the footage too, where he basically, while in the same room with Biden, turned Biden into a ghost. Everybody was hyper-focused on Obama's presence, and the president of the United States, Joe Biden, nobody even was blinking at him. Nobody was even looking at him. You probably saw that footage as well. So this man, Barack Obama, who in 8 years did so much to make the world a worse, more dangerous place, he's back, sort of like Hillary, who won't ever go away. But I think Obama is much more sophisticated and much more devious in his approach than Hillary is. She's kind of fumbling in the way that she works. Obama's much more of a smooth operator, but a very pernicious one at that.
And what that indicates is that they really have to somehow reinforce their message. And the message which is getting out of hand when the judge intervenes and says it is unlawful to demand that passengers wear these masks on planes anymore. And the overwhelming response was celebration. And that those kinds of things are threatening on top of the forced release of documents in which the trial data of these companies were so devastatingly clear that this is a very dangerous product that they've been now imposing on, enforcing on people as old, young as 5 years old. So you know, they need someone who they assume will be able to project and straighten the message out again and make it what it was 2 years ago. And I think that's clearly there is a constituency that will don't need even Barack Obama. They would have more or less accepted a Biden bumbling his way through a prepared statement. But if we try to read this and analyze what's going on, I think there is a little bit of trepidation in these circles of power. I think there have been some the case of the CEOs of both pharma and Moderna, Pfizer and Moderna, quitting on the same day and being immediately replaced by two others. There are people I think are running who know what they have done. I think doctors are trying to retract and find a space to actually to step away from their earlier egregious commitments to enforcing these inhumane, illegal policies.
That's absolutely the case. I've seen doctors who were just a few months ago, or let's say at the tail end of last year, who were writing pieces against the masking of children, but arguing that masking wasn't necessary because we had safe and effective vaccines, quote unquote, that could be administered to these children to prevent them from spreading a so-called virus, which had presented no lethality to them, presented no danger to them whatsoever. Now these doctors are walking it back and saying, I realize I was wrong in saying that. Well, okay, it's good that you've come around, but the damage has been done, and now
we need to ride this wave. We need to actually channel it. It's an energy that's potential for really getting across the board coalition to not only reverse but actually start to prosecute these monsters who have killed millions and millions and millions of people, who are their supposedly own fellow countrymen and constituents, let alone the Yemenis and the Congolese and all the other dark-skinned people of the global south that no one clearly gives a damn one bit, you know. So, but this is where I'm concerned, is that we're not going to be able to tap into this. There is not going to be momentum. And bringing in a Barack Obama can help dilute some of that potential for getting people across the board to say, hey, now let's work together. We have to now actually reverse some of this. The other things that are beginning to distract us, whether it be the Ukraine war, which has really effectively shut out the whole story about Corona. This is precisely the time when they started to release all of these damning documentation, right, from the Freedom of Information Act demands that were being made for the last 2 years. And it's not hit the mainstream media. And we now have Barack Obama coming back and saying misinformation is a very dangerous component to political life in America now. Disinformation about Ukraine, but also
let's not forget this is the man who presided over the drone murder of a 16-year-old American citizen in 2011.
In Yemen.
In Yemen, Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, after drone murdering his father, who is also an American citizen. And this is the man who is holding court and telling us that misinformation is killing people. This murderer, this absolute murderer who presided over the destruction of Libya, and as the first black president the U.S. ever had, turned Libya into a slave state, which is the cruelest of ironies that nobody who prostrates themselves before Obama is even aware of that fact. It's hideous, and it's so angering to me that this guy is being rolled out again. This guy who was president during the 2014 war on Gaza, when some of the worst crimes against humanity were committed against the occupied Palestinian people. The guy who was in office when the genocidal war on Yemen started. I mean, this guy's track record, this guy who ran on an anti-war message, and did everything the opposite, got rid of habeas corpus in the United States, did nothing to close Guantanamo. He's back again, and people are still fawning over him and falling for his con job all over again. But I think you're right, though, that the fact that he's sort of being trotted out again speaks to the fact that those in power are uncomfortable, and also perhaps maybe that they're not quite as resourceful as they make themselves out to be, or as we think they are, given that they have to sort of recycle Obama again.
Absolutely, and this is always something that I try to remind students, is that this is not fait accompli. The moment mm-hmm. we give up, revolutions like we saw in 1974 Portugal, or the resistance for the last 7 years in Yemen, would not be possible. You do need people to actually have the guts and actually stand on principle for something, and actually be willing to stand up to it. And this is clearly not societies. Now, Gilets Jaunes and the hundreds of thousands of people in Italy who are living a very scary life right now. Italy is just it's kind of Shanghai in a soft way at this stage, but there mm-hmm. Old people are not allowed onto buses or trains unless they get vaccinated. They get 100 euros deducted directly by the state from their pension funds if they don't prove that they have followed this regiment of booster shots. There are mm-hmm. huge food lines. People are not able to get food in proper amounts. And this is, again, in the middle of Europe, let alone going through Germany. I mean, I have to fly sometimes using German airlines, and they're everyone's wearing a mask. Everyone is completely bought into this agenda. And the moment you take off your mask to get a drink or something, you have people squealing on you. It's really remarkable to see fellow human beings react and act in this way, because they're the ones who are going to allow for the next stage, which is, you know, full scale cleansing of the elderly. They've already started doing this, right?
Yes.
And we know that the people in the old people's homes, these poor people who were denied access to their families, they shouldn't be in those homes anyways, but and nevertheless, they started dying in huge numbers. And we can just look at the statistics, and they're going to go after them again. And at some point,
there have been medical professionals who've courageously come forward. In the States, there's a nurse who came forward recently before Senator Ron Johnson's panel, his most recent panel in DC, his Senate panel, and she testified that she watched people be put on a track in hospitals to be murdered with remdesivir, which of course mm-hmm. was the main quote unquote therapeutic drug or treatment drug that was put on the schedule for people supposedly diagnosed with COVID-19. And then in the UK, we saw something very similar play out with midazolam and morphine, a cocktail that has murdered an untold number of people. And this was done on purpose, and medical facilities were incentivized to follow this program. They were incentivized for COVID cases. They were incentivized for COVID deaths. I mean, this was a systematic culling that happened and is still happening. And that includes with the injections as well. And as I said earlier, we have this new break schedule, so we have to throw it to a break right now. Yeah. But when we come back, we'll have the rest of the hour to speak. But I just wanted to add that on to your point. And when we come back, I want to talk about resistance. I want to talk about the masking thing, too, because I think that highlights, at least in the U.S., how far away we are from actually resisting. But after the break, more with Issa Blumey after this.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
As inflation starts to bite US consumers, it will no doubt be a big issue in the lead up to the November midterm elections. Democrats under the Biden administration will be concerned of a voter backlash fueled by skyrocketing prices. Republican candidates will be keen to capitalize on the Democrats' inability to control inflation. In press releases, tweets, and floor statements, etc., Republicans are literally saying the word inflation at six times the rates of Democrats. The Biden administration has no serious plan to ease inflation, but the US Federal Reserve, which is independent of government, has been largely responsible for the problem through its quantitative easing programs, propping up risky, overvalued assets. Since March 2020 alone, the Fed has created money to increase its assets by a massive $4.65 trillion. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Children in poverty, each one unique. Each one full of dreams. They're our hope, our future. They're the reason Children International exists. When the whole world changed, we developed new ways to reach children and families in poverty during these vulnerable times.
I'm learning every day.
I'm healthy and strong.
To learn more, go to children.org/help today.
Oh, yeah, that's the stuff. Oh, I haven't been through the car wash in ages. My gears are all clogged up and my wheels are as stiff as boards. Oh, and you could do with driving me a little more sensibly. All that revving actually increases CO2 emissions. Changing gears at lower revs can save you money too. And they say us cars don't care about the environment. Honestly, I don't know why I bother. Oh, yes, oh, just there.
Are you thinking what your car's thinking? Find out how to drive down your emissions and fuel costs by up to £120 a year at tfl.gov.uk.
The radio station everyone is talking about, TNT, where the longer you listen, the more reasons you find to keep listening. Keep listening. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am your host, Jesse Zerwell, and I've been speaking with frequent guest and my good friend, Issa Blumey. He is currently in Portugal, but he now resides in Sweden, where he teaches at Stockholm University. And Issa, when I think of real resistance, I think of the Palestinian resistance. I think of Ansar Allah. I think of Hezbollah as just a few examples. And they really are resisting globalism and the imposition of a globalist order upon their ways of life. And just recently, the Saudi-led coalition, and I'm bringing this up because I want to try to make a connection here. The Saudi-led coalition mobilized troops on the Marib front. And Marib, of course, is a very oil-rich region in Yemen. And in response, a spokesman for Ansar Allah said that this is a ceasefire violation, which it is. He warned against it and said that if these violations continue, because there have been many other ones, according to Ansar Allah, about 1,000 since April 1st, when the ceasefire took place by the Saudi quote-unquote coalition. He said things are going to get very painful for the coalition if they keep pushing. And to me, that's what real resistance looks like. But then here in the States, we have this quibbling over mask mandates and people actually putting themselves out on social media and saying, I'm being defiant and wearing my mask now that the government has said that we don't have to wear a mask. And it's just this complete detachment from any notion of what constitutes actual resistance, to the point where people think that wearing a mask, which does not work, which actually harms you, especially the longer you wear one of these obedience muzzles, they think that that constitutes resistance. And, you know, this is pretty widespread. I see people all the time in my neighborhood, a working class neighborhood in New Jersey, driving either alone or maybe with another person, and they're wearing masks in the car. And nobody's forcing them to do this. They're choosing to do this, thinking that, you know, it's protecting them, that there is something dangerous floating around out there. And it just makes me think that you put that next to resistance like that coming from Ansar Allah, and there's just no comparison. I'm really, really pessimistic about the West, and in particular the U.S. where I live, enough people standing up and actually presenting resistance to the government and its impositions. You know, the fact that we herald it as a victory that a judge strikes this down, as if we need a judge to tell us that we don't have to mask anymore. How about we just don't wear masks and we don't recognize the authority of these institutions to tell us what to do with our bodies? So maybe a tenuous connection there, but it's one that I see.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that it's inviting across the political spectrum, people to actually say, in defiance of a federal judge who, according to the United States constitutional system, actually has the responsibility of protecting explicitly the enforcement of law and the law and order from these kind of executive decrees that had been in place for the last 2 years. So even if you were someone progressive and you felt that there was some kind of health hazard that needed to be addressed by somehow isolating yourself from others, which many of the upper middle class very happily did, working from home, getting their mm-hmm. fancy food delivered, they have not suffered much of the consequence, while those people who have to actually work physically were the ones being forced to take shots, were being forced to live in conditions that were often quite abusive, still are, even more mm-hmm. so now. But what's so interesting is that that you have them actually making the argument now, as far as I understand, is that, you know what, who is this judge to intervene? I mean, let's empower Fauci. Let's empower the CDC even more. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what happened with 9/11, that we will have to give extra executive power to the president, just like with Bill Clinton during Bill Clinton, and just like with Barack Obama's period. The complete departure from one understanding the consequences, if you allow for this kind of creeping executive power where there will be no oversight, okay, let alone the Congress of the United States is completely corrupted and is of no use. But at least at the very symbolic level, at the level of understanding of how supposedly systems work, you would be opposed to what happened the last 2 years. And yet they are not. And many of them are actually screeching for for more of this executive decrees from a clearly corrupted, clearly infiltrated by industry sets of institutions that have now taken over the day-to-day lives of so many people in America. And the people who have objected to all this, that they have actually not either no recourse or they have not organized well enough. I mean, we had this quite remarkable moment with the truck drivers up in Canada, where they actually did occupy Ottawa for a while. That went really quiet very quickly. I mean, there was supposedly a solidarity movement in the United States. I don't know what happened with those truckers. Were they also, did they lose their license? Did they also lose their bank accounts? That also was celebrated by supposedly people on the left, that the state can actually freeze your bank accounts. You don't see that
yes.
this potentially has a way of silencing you forever? I mean, where are these people? Who are they?
The lockdown left, as they're sometimes referred to here, has been totally on board with the COVID-19 agenda from the beginning, and to the point where when the protests were happening in Ottawa, there were self-styled leftist journalists here in alternative media who were saying outright that there are fascists occupying Ottawa, and that people in power like Trudeau et al. Need to do something about it. I mean, these people, and these would be the same people who, these same people I saw advocating for mass injection, and also just baying into the wind.
Camps.
Noam Chomsky is a perfect example. Yeah. And, you know, just throwing it back to what we were talking about with 9/11, Noam Chomsky has been one of the most insidious with continuing this establishment narrative about what happened on 9/11, that everything happened as met the eye and as put out in the official narrative, that it was simply blowback from the Middle East, and it was 18 or 19 Saudi hijackers, and that's it. And there's nothing beyond that. The late Robert Fisk, for whom I have a lot of respect, unfortunately bought into that and peddled that as well. And I have a lot of problems with his reporting too, especially on Lebanon, and how he always felt the need to demonize Hezbollah or get a jab in on them when reporting on Israeli atrocities. Somehow he had to implicate Hezbollah in the blame, and I always found that disingenuous at best. But anyway, getting back to the left, in the U.S., it's completely fallen apart to the point where a lot of my friends and colleagues, we grew up as leftists, if you will, in a broad sense. But now it's almost an affiliation we're embarrassed to have because of what people, what people in the lockdown left have done. Saying that the removal of this mask mandate is akin to genocide. It's just, it's mind blowing, and it makes me think that in that respect, the COVID-19 project has been largely successful in demolishing a genuine left and just ravaging people's minds with psychological terror.
And right underneath everyone's noses, they've been culling a significant portion of the population that were considered very openly as dead weight. They no longer work. They're on retirement. They're getting Social Security or pension funds, which, of course, have no means to actually be sustainable anymore. We've been told for years that Social Security was going to run out. at some point. We've got to do something about that. So you can eliminate large numbers of people who are basically for the rest of their lives, who could live for 20, 30 years very happily still, and they certainly deserve to have a pension fund. They put their money into that system, but that money has been stolen and plundered already for a long time. But right underneath their noses, they have been being murdered. And what's so fascinating is that many members of the same families are, maybe they'll blame themselves for exposing their grandmother to COVID, or they didn't get her to take the third shot in time or something like that. But they are very reticent to make the extra effort to actually think and consider that this could have been due to the products that they were forcing their grandparents to take, or to the kind of so-called care they were getting in the retirement homes or in these hospitals when they were shoving them on, putting them on these ventilators, these breathing machines, which was guaranteed death. And it's quite startling to that even it goes so deep as within the family, that the family itself, which I have very cynical ideas about Western families anyways, they're more than happy to abandon their parents for old people's homes. And in the rest of the world, we have extended families and everyone lives in the same house. And I just had this conversation with my students in a class in Stockholm, and they find it very hard to believe that, you know, that there could be grandparents, parents, grandchildren all living under the same roof or same complex. And, you know, and they just can't understand why people would be so hesitant to abandon family for something like individual rights, which is something that's often preached in the West vis-a-vis the global South. And this is really manifests itself in horrifying ways in respect to caring for people who are the most vulnerable in our societies. And there's a fascinating information about the number of people who actually died during this coronavirus. It's unmanageable, the gap between the so-called rich countries and the so-called third world. The number of excess deaths in the third world is minimal compared to this skyrocketing excess death in the so-called post-industrial world, which is fascinating and really needs to be thought out. And maybe it will be, maybe it won't, maybe it will be pushed under the rug. Like it hasn't really been discussed in mainstream media as far as I'm concerned. And even those who are fighting this system are just, they have no means to actually bring in this tidal wave, this tsunami of information, this evidence of massive crimes against humanity. Well, we can't cry crimes of humanity if people themselves are not feeling that the crimes have been committed.
This
is so scary. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
No, that's okay. I was just going to add to that end, though, Reiner Fielmick and his Corona Investigative Committee have been doing an excellent job in providing testimonies from doctors, sociologists, researchers, disciplines across the board about all the aspects that make up this huge crime against humanity that is the COVID-19 project. And, unfortunately, it's difficult, if not impossible, to bring that before an actual judiciary. But he is, with his colleagues, Viviana Fisher being one of them, doing the best he can. And I advise people to go on to Odyssey and look up Corona Investigative Committee and look at the work that's being done, for starters. But there is so much more we could do and so much more you and I could discuss, but unfortunately we're at the end of the hour. But I hope that next week we can pick up our conversation. As always, if you're game, Issa Blumi.
Absolutely, Jesse. Thank you very much. Have a great week.
You too. Enjoy the rest of your time in Portugal, and I will talk to you soon.